is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this last 6 weeks' news is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 7 o'clock news, a close look at the Sergei Skripal nerve agent scandal from Salisbury. And a look around the world at the last 6 weeks of developments the corporate media have mostly either missed or misinterpreted for us. We go international in the second hour. That's after seven. But anyway, to begin with, we're going to start having a look at some of the local news. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and dry, highs of 3 Celsius this weekend, if you can call it high. Light snow and gusty winds tomorrow, light cloud and breezy on Sunday, but certainly not the horrendous snow whilst I was away. Next week, highs back up to 10 Celsius, warming up as the week progresses. Mainly cloudy and breezy week with sunny spells and some light rain. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of March, highs of 10 Celsius. Sunny spells, light showers and breezy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, Martin, how did you manage to get on whilst I was away here?
Well, rather well, actually, Tony. You might be surprised.
Rather well without me.
Yes.
So I suppose I was on about as far away from you as it's possible to be in New Zealand.
Yes.
So you're quite... That actually made life a bit easier, did it?
Well, in some respects, and in other respects, no.
I suppose, I mean, given Elon Musk and interstellar space travel, New Zealand really is as far away from Martin Summers and this studio as it's possible to get.
Yes, indeed. It's a small world, Tony, isn't it?
Just as a thought, how far away is the other side of the world?
It's about 25,000 miles, isn't it?
No, it's about 14,000 miles, 15,000 miles.
Is it? Yes. Oh, 25,000 miles is a circumference, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's half a circumference. Yeah. It's actually quite sort of small, really, if you think about it. Anyway, Labour councillor for Lawrence Hill, Margaret Hickman, was supposed to be here tonight, but has pulled out for the third time, each time citing ill health, as did Tory Richard Eddy beforehand. But back from 6 weeks in Hong Kong, New Zealand and the Cook Islands, that was quite a tour for me. And next week we'll have the first of two extended interviews recorded live in the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club about the tightening tensions with China. Martin, Hong Kong and China, it is actually quite a pinch point between the East and the West, a tiny little province. Historically, really, we shouldn't be there, should we?
Well, I think you can either see it as a place of conflict or a place of dialogue. And I would obviously, you know, prefer to see it as the latter rather than the former.
Yeah, but it isn't like that. That's not really where it's working, because people in Hong Kong do not really want to be ruled by China, understandably. It's a different kind of... there's just a different culture, completely different culture in the two, in the new territories, in Kowloon and Hong Kong, which is the sort of mainland part, because historically Britain just had Hong Kong, and then there was wars with the Chinese, so the Brits decided we're going to take a whole bunch of bits of the mainland too, and that's what they call Kowloon in the new territories. So certainly the people in Hong Kong I spoke to, not just in the Foreign Correspondents Club, are really worried about China restricting some of their freedoms, particularly freedom of speech and those sorts of human rights, and starting to say, well, actually, you're going to have Communist Party people running this city. You can't have elections.
Well, there never were elections under the British either, until the suggestion was that they were going to be put under the Chinese, and then the British started to liberalise the setup. But the Chinese Communist Party were pretty annoyed with that, saying, well, you didn't have any elections when you were running it. We want to take it over as a going concern with no elections. And don't forget the umbrella the umbrella revolution movement, which began in Hong Kong some while ago. They were. You've got to remember that the Chinese Communist Party are very paranoid about being undermined by Western powers who are quite hostile to their project, and they see Hong Kong as a potential Achilles heel for the whole of China. So they're not likely to back down on giving Hong Kong...
But you used the word paranoid there. At the moment, you've got a legislative assembly in Hong Kong, which is half and half. Roughly half of the MPs, or whatever you want to call them, councillors, are appointed from bodies like the teaching unions. There are a whole bunch of them that do that, and only the other half are elected ordinary people. Yeah. The Chinese are now starting to say, well, XYZ elected people aren't allowed to stand. I mean, that's clearly, you know, it's a red rag to a bull to the Hong Kong
people. It may well be, but you've got to see the wider context of the desire to destabilize mainland China of the Trump regime, for example. They're not happy to, the Western powers have never really accepted the Communist Party set up, and they've got a good reason to be paranoid about the West's intentions towards them. That doesn't mean that the Hong Kongers haven't got their own gripes and grievances, which are perfectly legitimate.
Okay, anyway, we're hearing much more about that over the next couple of weeks, because I spoke to some people in the Correspondence Club as part of the 1997 handover agreement signed between China's Deng Xiaoping and our own Chris Patton. Hong Kong will be keeping its own currency, the Hong Kong dollar, and state legislature, as well as the self-run Hong Kong police until 2047. No interference then by China for another 50 years. That's the theory, but what about the practice? As East closes in around West in Hong Kong, we'll be going in deep to discover what journalists there make of the Communist Party on the mainland, with two of Hong Kong's longtime newspaper correspondents, David O'Rear, an American, and Philip Bowring, who's British, over the next couple of weeks. I also interviewed a New Zealander, Dr. Jacob Cohen, who wrote a controversial book, Murder at Pike River Mine, which refers to the 2010 Greymouth New Zealand coal mine disaster, where the mine rescue service weren't allowed in to rescue people, and people were actually crawling out, but the mine rescue service weren't allowed into the mine. His conclusion was the mainly open cast Australian company that owned the loss making mine wanted rid of it without the investors having the chance to pull out, and without evidence of any of their culpability, for example, not having proper safety systems in their horrifying tale, Martin.
Well, it is, but I mean, it's obviously pretty detailed stuff, and I don't know much about it.
Do you remember it back in 2010?
Not really. When you mentioned it on email to me, I was made aware of it, but other than that, I wasn't particularly aware of it.
Okay, so we'll be doing that over the next few weeks. Singapore, 7,000 miles away, and a 14-hour flight. Crikey, that was quite a difficult one. Went on various different airlines, British Airways, pretty good. Singapore Airlines, wonderful. But the thing I noticed coming back is it's a bit of culture clash, really. I think whenever you go anywhere in the world, you come back and certain things hit you. The whinging Brits. I mean, the Brits seem to be whinging all the time, even on Singapore Airlines, which is a very, the service there is fantastic, actually. It would do almost anything for you. Keep serving you as many drinks as you want, pretty much. And they're really, really helpful. And yet still, the Brits are whinging. I get the impression a bit that we're not publicly criticising our leaders and our ruling class enough, and so when that happens, that people sort of almost look around themselves immediately for someone to criticise.
Well, I mean, these are very broad brush allegations or comments. I don't really know what to say.
You don't have to say anything, actually. I mean, but all I'm saying is, when you come back from being abroad, I think you notice these things more. You tend to notice these things more. I think the Brits look miserable. You compare them to the New Zealanders, and even the Singapore people. I just find that the people in the street here, particularly people who are maybe a bit down on their luck, haven't got a job, whatever, there's more miserable-looking people here.
Well, that's because it's a bigger country with a bigger underclass and repressed classes. There's always been a pretty hard time for people on the bottom.
Well, I look around,
bottom rung here.
Comparing it, say, to New Zealand, I look around and I think people, the government here just does not care about people. It doesn't care about people. Over there, you find that facilities seem to be there for, there's much more of an idea that the government is there to sort of just make things easy for people. Here, it's like the opposite.
Well, don't forget, we've got the whole history which weighs us down, as Marx pointed out. The traditions of all the dead generations weigh like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And of course, in newer countries like New Zealand and Singapore, which have reinvented themselves, Singapore since World War II, they've got less of this baggage which we carry. We've still got the House of Lords, we've still got the monarchy, we've still got the aristocracy who own most of the land, we've still got the City of London with its fingers in every pie around the planet.
Bristol's got its own merchant venturers who
all of that rich history leads us to carry a lot of baggage which some other places don't have.
Also, Singapore, one of the things in Singapore, apparently they don't, it's a criminal offence to be a member of a secret society. I imagine that it might even be true in Hong Kong too, because there seems to be more consciousness of things like the triads over there and the fact that secret societies can be used to take over political institutions, that sort of thing.
Singapore's
got... And it's seen as parallel, really, with kind of gang culture, the secret society.
Yeah, but Singapore is basically an authoritarian regime. It's run by social democrats rather than anybody else, but it's quite difficult for anybody other than them to have any power. And don't forget, in a small country like that, you can kick people out if you don't like them. Just expel them.
Well,
off you go.
Just to give you a brief, a little snippet from one of the things that the correspondents were saying to me in Hong Kong, was that in Singapore they have a very simple system, an authoritarian socialist system, and they have a very simple way of getting rid of anybody that starts to get rid of or threaten that system. I mean, for example, lots and lots of things like housing, things like that, public ownership. Mm-hmm. Anyone that comes along and tries to predate on that, the Singapore authorities, the ruling class, they just bankrupt them.
Yeah,
they find a way of bankrupting them of some sort, just taking away their money.
The model for the economic reform in China in the 1980s onwards was Lee Kuan Yew's Singapore. And, it's essentially authoritarian market socialism. But, of course, on a continent-wide basis, which is what you're talking about in China, it's not going to be quite the same as in a city-state like Singapore.
We'll be hearing some quotes, I would imagine, from Craig Murray, the former Uzbekistan ambassador, about this whole Russian spy Salisbury confected story. That's what I call it. But one of the things he said is our ruling class... That the idea that our ruling class are the good guys is for the birds.
Well, it is. Of course it is. I mean, one of the things that's made my blood boil over the last week or so with this case is the across-the-board assumption that we would never do something like this, therefore it must be those baddie Russians. And of course, the people who know nothing of what MI5 is about, MI6, all they know about is, watching James Bond movies at Christmas, and then they extrapolate from that must be what it's about. And of course, it's not what it's about at all. The rest of the world does not regard MI6 as a benevolent organisation. They are seen as tricky, devious, and ruthless. And they are.
But surely they're not going to manoeuvre Britain into a position of war with Russia.
Well, that's what this is all about, Tony. Are we going to cover this?
We'll leave that a bit.
Yeah,
a bit
I think
later.
If we're going to cover it. Let's cover it properly.
Let me go through some of the other things. Just impressions from travel. Biometrics at the airports everywhere. Fingerprints in Singapore. Facial recognition at Heathrow. This whole idea of biometric identity. There's becoming less and less people involved in the whole process of customs, immigration, and all that. And the whole thing is becoming pretty much done by computers, artificial intelligence, that sort of thing. And your identity is becoming sort of digitised, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think the concentration on airports is, people imagine that airports are the place where things happen. And the reason why things happen in airports is because that's where the state's got the most control over what goes on. If you were a serious terrorist organisation, you wouldn't attack planes and airports because they're a hard target. You go after softer targets than that, etc. So, I mean, this whole idea of making airports where things happen is largely because airports are controlled, like Schiphol Airport and other airports, by Israeli intelligence companies which are related to Mossad. And that's why these scams and provocations can take place in airports, because that's where they've actually got the most control.
New Zealand, amazing place, wonderful place, but there's all sorts of, I mean, for one peculiarity was quite a lot of the petrol stations in New Zealand, you drive in, there's absolutely nobody there. So the whole process is you and a credit card, and that's the way it's done. I just think, you know, this is technology. Is if you've got a big wadge of cash, you can't, it's the same actually over here with public transport. If you want to get on a bus over here, largely, they say, well, you've got to book it online. Well, hang on, here's my 20, 30 quid. I want a bus ticket. No, you can't get on the bus. But it's the same sort of thing I'm saying with this technology just becoming almost overwhelming that you can't. And at a petrol station, there's nobody there to make sure that you're not messing around or whatever. It just seems beyond belief that you want to completely get rid of people from that situation.
Well, you think about the overall macroeconomic effects of that. When large sections of the population become surplus to requirements, and unless you've got some mechanism for reintegrating those people into the economy, then you're just going. I mean, people are going to get expert at robbing petrol stations with no people in them.
I'm just saying, effectively, the idea of you sort of turn up the petrol station with your money, and it just seems to me bonkers, really, incredible that you would think that that sort of situation can be just left to anybody with a card and nobody there to supervise.
Well, they're pushing for the getting rid of cash all over the world, particularly. I mean, they did a whole thing in India where they tried to get rid of cash. It's absolutely extraordinary, and that was pushed by USAID, which is the American so-called arm of help and aid to third world countries, and of course it was a big disaster for very poor people because they don't have access to bank accounts.
Well, they're doing a similar
credit cards, etc.
In Finland and Sweden,
you can see it almost working in countries like that because they're very developed countries where probably everybody has got some kind of.
I was expecting
card.
To come back,
but even so, it's sinister.
Metro bus operators still not quite going.
No,
and that's apparently going to be all. You can't use cash to get on that either.
Well, yes, I know, but I mean, these are wider issues. The idea of them getting rid of cash is so that they can control what everybody's doing. But I think there's a huge resistance in society, ingrained at a very deep level, to that. People like to be able to spend their money without people knowing what they're doing, and people will find ways around it. They generally do. Any authoritarian system, however carefully calibrated, people find ways around it.
It just seems to me that if this is done, that these transport companies are doing this just for their own interest. They're not interested in the customers.
Well, the answer, of course, in terms of transport, is just have it for free. People just get on and get off, and you don't need to pay anybody for anything. So there's no point no need for biometric checks.
Also, I mean, another thing is the earthquakes over in New Zealand have affected it quite. I mean, if you remember the Christchurch earthquake, I visited Christchurch, and it was like a war zone. They have people going around, right, that building's got to come down, this building's got to come down. I mean, there was something like probably a half of the buildings in Christchurch had either been demolished or were just sealed off. Unbelievable the way it's affected the city. And one of the things also found out is that, do you know what the worst affected building was?
I don't know.
It was the New Zealand TV building, which was hit by the main force of the earthquake somehow.
Well, you can imagine that bigger, more substantial buildings are more likely to be affected than smaller, more flimsier buildings.
But they're definitely calling out for civil engineers over in New Zealand. Anyone that would like to work in a nicer country than Britain, warmer, etc. New Zealand is desperate for people to go over there to do any kind of civil engineering type work. And there are other sorts of jobs which they're really looking for. So there's a whole list
sheep
of things.
Sheep shearing?
Well, actually, there's more cattle than sheep over there these days. Then we went to the Cook Islands and Rarotonga, which was fascinating to see, with These beautiful lagoons, the fish, thousands of fish, and really beautiful, but a simple way, Martin, completely different to here. The people don't have jobs, but they have a house and they've got land. They potter about. There's no need for the dole, pretty much, over there.
In New Zealand?
No, in Cook Islands.
Oh, the Cook Islands. Well, yes, I mean, they couldn't afford the dole if they wanted it, could they? So that's why they have to manage like
but
that.
But almost everybody's got a house. Everyone's got bits of land. They grow their own food and they potter around. Mm-hmm. They don't really need to have some kind of job.
Yeah, but there are other parts of Polynesia where life is not as rosy as
well,
that.
It is in the Cook Islands. What I'm saying is, it's like a million miles from here, and it is the other side of the world. But, I mean, if people here had a home and some land, they wouldn't need to be, we wouldn't need to have the dole. We wouldn't need to have all these kind of housing benefits stuff. It just seems we've come a long, long way from the sensible idea that everyone should have somewhere to live, these basic things as a right.
Well, we never had that in this country. We were talking about Britain and why we're miserable. That's because we've never had it, ever. And we've always had to work for the bosses here, since way back when.
And actually, the situation is getting worse, isn't it? There's the home ownership statistics are going down and down all the time.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, and homelessness statistics are going up. It's not just a question of whether people own their own homes or not, which is a pretty, you know, secondary matter, really. It's whether they've got a roof over their head at all.
Also, we saw Jacinda Ardern in Rarotonga last Thursday. Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks before that, met the driver for a guy called Bill Crow in Wellington. And he was the guy that ran the official New Zealand government brothel. And I was quite interested to find that they had these sort of...
such a thing?
Yes. In Wellington.
Only one?
Yeah, well, yes. It's extremely... Everything's very well regulated. Yeah. Hmm. And the idea was that the prostitutes that worked there actually got sort of... quite often got married off to some of the diplomats and the staff that were funneled through the brothel. But, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? In a way, you do wonder whether governments are really just like... sort of gangster operations, and they have to have all the same sort of things. Maybe they're better regulated and a bit more, should we say, high quality than a gangster mobster situation. But you know, that's not so strange, is it? That a government should have its own brothel.
There's plenty of political theory that suggests that states are fundamentally predatory, and that they, you know, that you can. And this is, of course, is. You know, it's linked to on the right to the idea that the market is somehow free, but in actual fact, of course, what we're dealing with is social power, whether exercised through the state directly or exercised privately. Some people are big bosses, and other people tend to be the bossed, and that's the way the world has always run. Apart from in
so, do you think the British government has its own official brothel somewhere in London?
No, we haven't got official brothels here in this country.
Well, look,
but there will be tolerated. There are tolerated.
Don't MI6 have their own brothels?
Yeah, they will have, but they're not officially tolerated. It's a different thing.
Well, it's just kept secret, surely, yeah, exactly. Like it is in New Zealand. I mean, this is not official. This is not sort of talked about.
I presume what you were suggesting is, I mean, they do have official brothels in the Netherlands. They are state, well, they're not state run, but they're state regulated, yeah? And other countries do have them. It's not unheard of. In France, there used to be absolutely the norm for hundreds of years.
What I'm saying is it's run by the government. It's probably the Foreign Office running it in New Zealand, but it's not spoken about. The idea is you don't talk about it, but it is very well regulated. It's for diplomats.
Well, yes, but I mean, if it's not official, it's not official. It's either official or it's not
official.
Well,
they would probably deny it if you told them.
Well, in other words, it's unofficial, but it happens.
Yeah.
And you can be sure that similar setups exist in this country, which we've heard nothing about.
Anyway, maybe I'll put a link on our show page to the chap Bill Crow, who ran the official, unofficial New Zealand government brothel. And a chap that owned our hotel when we went to the Cook Islands is an ex-Royal Marine, who, interestingly, he'd been a port and down guinea pig in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. None too impressed or pleased with his treatment by the military there.
No, well, I mean, Portland Down doesn't have a brilliant reputation. As you know, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that they murdered lots of people that were sent there for supposedly tests on the common cold. And, you know, probably...
Well, murder is deliberate, isn't it? But some people...
Well, they were reckless to the... I mean, people died as a result of what they were doing, let's put it that way. Nobody was held to account for it.
Well, they have to a certain extent, haven't they? Because there's been quite a lot of compensation paid out to people. I mean, that's
Can't compensate dead people.
That's partly, yeah, to the families, but that's partly due to the work of Points West here in Bristol, who did quite a lot of good investigative journalism into and spoke to some of the victims and actually helped get that whole thing, sort of the inquiry and the case through the courts.
Well, yes. And it would be much better if independent journalists and local police officers were investigating this recent incident. But, of course, it's been completely taken over by the Spooks and the military.
So, I mean, what do you know what happened at Porton Down?
When, the experiments? Well, lots of National Service people were told that, you know, if you want to get 2 weeks off, you know, jankers and square bashing, go to Porton Down. They're investigating the common cold.
And an extra £10 a week on your salary.
Yeah, and quite a lot of people said, okay, that sounds like a cushy number. But what they're actually doing is testing chemical warfare agents on them, and some of them died. Unless most of them were made very ill, as you would be. But of course, they wouldn't. There was no informed consent involved. It was completely manipulative.
Well, I mean, it's horrific to think that the state can treat people like that. I mean, I suppose this is the army. Is there any kind of checks and balances?
Not really. Once you're in the armed forces, it's all related legally to the crown. So, for example, if you are on manoeuvres and you die, like the SAS reserves who died in the Brecon Beacons some years ago, you're not even entitled to compensation because it's the normal rules don't apply. And so, for example, they've not been able to enforce no smoking bans in prison in Britain, which probably isn't a good idea in my view anyway, but the reason being that the prisons as Crown property are exempt from the normal British law. And once you join the armed forces, you are then directly related, you know, you're directly employed by the Crown, and therefore normal rules about what can and can't happen to you will go out the window.
And this whole business of can we trust Porton Down, it's really obviously no is the answer to that.
I think that's quite right.
Because back in Tuesday, the 1st of August 2000, in The Independent, I put a link to this on our show page too, is a headline, Porton Down, investigation now looking into 45 deaths. So it's not just one or two.
No, are the ones we know about.
The police are investigating chemical warfare tests at Porton Down in Wiltshire, thought to be examining at least 45 deaths. Their inquiry initially focused on the death of Ronald Madison, who died in 1953, exposed to the nerve gas at trials at Porton Down. Wiltshire police are believed to be looking into another 45 cases where relatives claim death was caused by the tests. Now, this is Wiltshire police investigating, but now Wiltshire police in this current story are being sidelined, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they were taken off it almost straight away. And this should be a signal to people. This is a flashing light. Why have the local police been taken? Oh, it's too important for the local police to investigate. Nothing is too important for the local police to investigate. Because let's face it, in the bigger scheme of things, the British state are suspects in this case. And if you had a genuine independent police investigation, they would have to put the British state as one of the suspects in the case. And that should be obvious to everybody. But, of course, they're not. And the fact that Porton Down, as the Russians pointed out, if they were able to identify this nerve agent so quickly, it's because they must have samples of it themselves to compare with it.
We'll be talking about that after seven, but we'll be looking at the local news after some music.
Let me be
from 1988. That's and you don't hear that on the radio as much as we ought to, really. But anyway, Martin, let's have a look at some of the local stuff that's been going on more recently. I mean, I'm not really talking about trying to go back through everything that's happened in Bristol, for goodness sake. But it's an interesting story just come up about, it's actually in the National Daily Mail, about, it's entitled, "If You Go Down in the Woods Today, Bears Could Return to Ancient Woods in Britain After More Than a 1,000 years, a £5 million plan." Now, I've come across this whole sort of rewilding agenda quite a lot. It's been pushed by George Monbiot and others. And it does strike me that this is a bit, actually a little bit Nazi about this, which is because they had this whole program, didn't they, to try and reintroduce wolves and wild animals in Germany. And they had this, I think they're called the Auraks, these kind of quite aggressive giant bulls that they wanted to be able to roam free in Germany, and I'm, you know, is this a good way to spend £5 million?
Is this a local story in the sense it's going to
happen?
Well,
it's in the Daily Mail. It's happening around here. Yeah.
Where are they going to? I'm curious to know which woods they're going to bring the bears.
It's funny because you were saying just before we came on the air that one of the children at school had a sort of bad dream about bears or something.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd have to think. Well, what woods are suitable for the reintroduction of bears around Bristol? And frankly, I can't think of any that would be at all
suitable.
Well,
I can figure that out, but just tell us a story about your kiddie at school.
Well, I mean, kids dream about bears as a negative thing, so this lad had a dream about bears coming into his house at night and he was frightened. It was a nightmare. And you know, bears have a cuddly reputation, but they also have a fearsome reputation. I mean, people, where bears are indigenous and still active in, you know, the US and Canada and so on, people try to give them a wide berth, even if they love them, because they're dangerous.
Well, they are dangerous, extremely dangerous, and there are probably good reasons why. I mean, is there any real evidence that Britain was populated by bears?
Oh, yeah, it must have been at one stage, for sure.
And didn't sort of the very kind of basic vestigial people who lived here decide, right, we're going to get rid of these things?
Well, I mean, yeah, both bears and wolves are in our fairy stories because they were regarded as kind of enemies of humanity and therefore to be dealt with.
The scheme called Bearwood would see Eurasian brown bears, which can grow up to 8 feet tall, rearing their cubs exactly as they did in medieval England. So they'll be home for the bears, but we've got 400 people sleeping on the streets in the city. The creatures would not be left to roam totally wild. They'd be fenced in, and keepers would supplement their diet to keep them well fed. Keepers was okay. The project's due to go before South Gloucestershire Council later this month. Work could begin in the summer if approved. Bristol Zoological Society received donations towards the cost of the project, but needs to find an extra £2 million. All the buildings would be constructed to blend in with their surroundings, said Bristol Zoo. The plan was not already ambitious enough. I mean, I'm reminded of the Old Men at the Zoo book. The zoo people are really involved in all this. They were a bunch of fascists too. I just find this whole business a little bit disturbing, that this is seen to be some sort of, it almost seems like animals are being treated better than human beings.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see some point in it. I mean, but presumably it's going to be private woodland to which people don't have access at the minute anyway. And you know, in Scotland, when they were talking about rewilding wolves, there was a lot of resistance to it because basically everywhere in Scotland is free to people to walk on, because they passed legislation in the Scottish Assembly to make a right to roam in memory of John Smith. So anybody can roam anywhere on the mountains of Scotland, and therefore, if you're going to have wolves, they have to be fenced off, which means that people can't go in where they are.
I'll put a link off onto this on our show page, and you're absolutely right about the Scots. And there were some fellas from Neudart, which is right out on the west coast, very independent-minded people. And he stood up in the middle of this presentation by a British guy saying that he wanted to reintroduce these wolves and things and fence it off, saying, well, this is, you're trying to tell me I can't walk on my own land? We're going to fence it off, you can't walk there anymore, you know. So there is a lot of, I mean, there was certainly massive hostility there to this whole concept.
Yeah, but you could imagine if it was
bringing dangerous wild animals back.
Let me play devil's advocate here. If you were to create a habitat for bears, which was fenced off, which presumably, if it's run by Bristol Zoo, they might even allow people in there under supervision. You know, you'd go in there with keepers and, you know, people with guns if necessary to shoot the bears if they get out of hand. But I mean, what you're talking about there really isn't rewilding. It's basically an outdoor zoo. That's
it's
all it is.
It's a commercial operation. Yeah. It sounds to me like just more money making. I bet there won't be Russian bears.
Well, where else are they going to get them from? We'll have to get American bears in, won't we?
Yes, they probably would.
They don't want Russian bears.
Student victory after a three-day occupation of Bristol University proves direct action works. The students staged a sit-in for 60 hours inside the Vice-Chancellor's office to support striking lecturers and staff in a national dispute over pension cuts. Well, they're robbing the teachers, the university teachers' pensions, and students have come in solidarity with them.
Well, that's all very commendable of them. I don't think, from my knowledge, that the university teachers are very happy with the deal that's been suggested. And, there's still a lot of discontent about it.
Well, the office of the university vice-chancellor, Professor Hugh Brady, he's now saying, and the university are now saying, that they will lobby not to have the pension pot robbed. I mean, isn't robbery a crime?
Well, I mean, if you sign a contract as a 20-something university teacher, you're basically signing a contract where you know that with the level of education you've got, if you went into the private sector, you could probably make a lot more money. And one of the things that makes people stay in the university system is because they've got a guaranteed pension at the end of it. And that's a contract. And, you can see the point that the lecturers have. Look, we've signed a contract that says we've got a certain pension at a certain level, and just because you say you haven't got any money, you're not going to pay it.
Well, isn't it contract fraud of some sort?
Well, it's basically reneging on a contract.
Just more fraud. Hey, folks, rule of law seems to be going down the tubes here. Also, you mentioned this, I think, with Steve Satan last week. Plans for Bristol congestion charge, 300 deaths a year have been linked to pollution. Well, that sounds like that's two completely different stories. They're doing this because they want the money, not because they want to stop pollution deaths. Thousands of drivers could have to pay to enter Bristol's council considers a congestion charge. This actually, I think, is just more evidence that there was no real intention for Metrobus to help ease congestion because they wanted to introduce a congestion charge.
Well, I think you're getting it the wrong way around. The congestion charging is going to be controversial because it's basically changing the way people act, that people have got used to
it. It's opening up a brand new market. Some whole people from nowhere, you can just give them a nice little ticket that says, you are now in charge of collecting this congestion charge. Give us a cut of it.
But listen,
it's a racket, Martin.
The congestion charge in London, which was brought in by Ken Livingstone, was not got rid of by Boris Johnson, and I don't think anybody is going to get rid of it anytime
soon. No, but
the reason
they had a congestion charge in London is because they nobbled Ken Livingstone's attempt to make public transport free.
Oh, yes, and what we really want to have is free public transport, and then we have to weather with congestion charges. But inevitably,
if they had free public transport, there would be no need for
any of
this.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't have, free...
Take it off the rates.
Well, indeed, and in fact, it was perfectly feasible to have free public transport on the rates in London at the time because the business rate was still in the control of the local authority. And the fair plan of having, a flat fare of a pound to go anywhere was a step towards that. And in the long run, we probably will bring in free public transport. But in the short run, you've still got to basically deal with, the world not as we would like it, but as it is. And, until there's actually been a real shake-up to the system, truly radical solutions won't be considered.
The Guardian newspaper has been attacked by Filden MP Jack Lopresti for scaremongering over Airbus exit report. Jack Lopresti, Conservative MP for Filden and Bradley Stoke, accused the left-leaning media outlet of needlessly worrying workers in Bristol. Well, we've been worrying workers in Bristol by talking about the possibility of Airbus pulling out quite a lot as well, but obviously we're not as important as The Guardian. But Guardian has been branded irresponsible by Jack, who criticised the newspaper for scaremongering. The left-leaning media outlet urged its readers to vote to remain in the European Union, published an article with the headline, Airbus may leave the UK unless there is urgent clarity on Brexit trade. Well, I can tell you that before the Brexit thing, Airbus were planning to leave Britain anyway because they didn't include the Filton plant on their annual report. It just wasn't there, and also people have been hearing rumours up there for years that Airbus were pulling out. We've also got the horrendous situation for people up there that it looks like GKN could be pulling out, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Jack Dreamy.
Mr Speaker,
yes.
Last week GKN workers came to Parliament. typically 25 and 30 years service, their mums and dads before them working for a British engineering icon 259 years old. Sat opposite were the three fabulously wealthy owners of Melrose, determined to stage a hostile takeover of their company, break it up and sell it off. Can I ask the Prime Minister this? She told Parliament she would act in the national interest. The next 10 days will decide the future. Will she use the powers that she has to intervene to block this hostile takeover in the British national interest?
To the honourable gentleman, as he knows, the business secretary has been speaking to both of these companies on an impartial basis. We will always act in the UK national interest. Actually, it's under this government that we've seen the changes introduced to the takeover code to provide greater transparency, to give target firms more time to respond. There are a narrow range of scenarios where ministers can intervene on mergers on public interest grounds, but we will always ensure that we act in the national interest.
I mean, Airbus possibly pulling out, GKN being taken over, maybe moved. What's going to be? I suppose Filton, it's just going to be more houses up there, Martin.
Well, it may be so if that's what transpires.
Interesting, wasn't it, that Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary, came up to Rolls-Royce up there this week?
I didn't see that.
That's where he gave his speech about the whole Russian business, and he said Putin must shut up and go away.
Yes, and he did it in front of a British and an American flag, I saw.
Yes.
Did you see the picture of it?
Yes.
So he had a British flag and a US flag. You wonder, why is the British Defence Secretary sitting in front of a US flag?
Well, because he's part of the US Empire.
Well, I think that pretty much answers my question.
The idea of, you know, these massively important engineering firms, Airbus and GKN, and all the jobs associated with them just... gone.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of hostile takeovers is peculiar. Is in Britain, hostile takeovers are the norm, as they are in the United States. In Germany, hostile takeovers are very rare because they've got their company structure basically makes it very difficult. And, you know, they regard the idea that you know, if somebody can just buy out a company when the existing managers and workers don't want that, that's the sort of thing that they don't really like, and they don't allow it.
If I had a friend at a big, powerful bank who said, here's £8 billion for you, Tony, you can go and make a hostile takeover bid for any company you want.
Yeah.
All you need to do is to, I suppose, talk to that bank and say, well, I'm going to do this and this and this with the firm asset strip it. The bank will give you the money.
That's right. And, of course, they then load the firm with the debt of the money they've borrowed to take it over,
so
which is the
earth?
Problem with Premier Division football clubs.
Well, why
in Britain.
On earth doesn't the government intervene here? Say, well, actually,
we don't believe in intervening.
We need these jobs here.
No, Britain, you've got to remember.
We want this company to be controlled from within.
The British philosophy is that's for the market to decide. It's not allowed in Germany, and it wouldn't be allowed in Japan.
And that philosophy,
but we know better.
And that philosophy is for the birds, because you end up with nothing left.
Well, that's right. And the fact is, we've been pursuing that philosophy for years. Years and years, and this Tory government is still, pursuing that philosophy, and that's why Germany exports massively to China, and we don't, because we don't do anything like that anymore.
Okay, Bristol business chief wants the homeless banned, as terrorists could hide devices in their belongings. The head of the city centre business has written to court about rough sleepers in the area. I think this is John Hurst, but is that true?
We covered that the other week. Yes, I mean his getting down on the homeless. You know, you can understand why business oriented. I think he actually works for the council. He's not a.
He's chief executive of Destination Bristol. He's one of the city elite.
Yes. So in other words, but I mean, you can it's pretty outrageous that he wants the homeless kicked off the streets, to help the businesses in the city centre. I mean, there's lots of social questions about whether that's justifiable. But the idea that the homeless are terrorists is, it's laughable, isn't it? It's a bit like Gavin Williams.
No, they're not saying that they are terrorists. They're saying that terrorists could hide bombs in their belongings.
Well, yes, they could.
They could probably hide. They probably hide bombs in John Hurt's car.
They could. They'd be better off just bringing, parking cars in car parks with bombs, wouldn't they? I mean, it smacks of exaggeration and bad faith.
It's incredibly pig-headed of some super rich elite person to blame these poor homeless people and not to help them.
Well, this is a fundamental problem with Britain anyway. We shouldn't have all these people sleeping on the streets, but we sold off all the council houses in the 1980s, and there's nowhere for them to go.
It's almost a provocation saying something like this.
Well, it is, yes.
It's inviting people to, you know, to hate him and to start saying, well, I mean, who the hell is it that's running this city? If you think you can start blaming the homeless people, because he's got access to headlines in the Bristol Post and the homeless people aren't being listened to.
Well, indeed. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's just ludicrous. It's, it just, you know, it just demands a snort.
You know what? It's like,
really?
You know, when I was at school, they used to talk about capitalism being decadent, you know. This is getting decadent, isn't it?
Capitalism is very, very decadent. We're on the edge of capitalism. I mean, capitalism doesn't really exist because of the bailout of the banks in 2008. Capitalism died right there and then.
Okay,
but everybody pretends that it still exists, but it's gone, long gone.
Any idea how long Metro Bus is going to be before it actually starts going anyway? First Group are going to be running it, which is incredible. Since First Group were responsible for the Croydon tram crash, they've been decided to, in which several people died, were negligent in that because they were warned about the problems by the drivers and then just ignored them, and so the crash then happened. But First Group has been, I was just looking at this story from last year, I'd missed this, there's been an investors' revolt in First Group over the appointment of former Carillion finance chief. First Group was hit by the fallout from the implosion of Carillion after shareholders in the bus and transport operator rebelled against the board appointment of building contractors' former finance chief. More than a fifth of First Group investors voted against the election of Richard Adam as an independent non-executive in an embarrassing blow to the transport group. Mr. Adam was one of Carillion's top bosses, serving the finance director between 2007 and the end of last year. However, his legacy at the construction business has been severely tarnished by this profit warnings. And, of course, subsequently, after this article was written, the collapse of Carillion. So this is great, isn't it? Our public transport on the board of that is this lunatic. I mean, you can only call him that. Surely he shouldn't be able to be a director after being in charge of finance at Carillion.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But as you know, the old boy network is pretty strong in Britain and particularly strong in Bristol.
How is it that someone who's been partly responsible for the collapse of some of Carillion, the massive Carillion, is now thought to be OK to run our buses and trains to and from London?
Well, it's because, as I just said, the old boy network is still alive and kicking, isn't it? Jobs for the boys.
Back to Prime Minister's questions again, and this is about really, I suppose, the contrast between giving bankers money and taking money away from people on universal credit.
Bill Esterson.
Mr. Speaker, the UK has the lowest growth in the G7. So why is the government's answer to this to give handouts to some of the wealthiest bankers to fund an already lavish lifestyle paid for by taking the crumbs off the table of those on universal credit whose children depend on free school meals?
Prime Minister!
First of all, the Honourable Gentleman might not have noticed that the wealthiest 1% of people in this country are now paying the biggest share of tax, 28%, than they ever did under a Labour government. But if he's referring to the bank levy, can I also say to him, it was the Conservative Party that introduced the bank levy that has raised £15 billion and is predicted to raise a further £11 billion that we can spend on public services. It is the Conservative government that is changing the way we do it, so we do it in a better way. So in future, we will be raising nearly £19 billion extra from the banks over the next 5 years. That's £3 billion more money from the banks to be spent on public services.
Well, that presumes that the banks don't collapse, of course. And that's they're basically living on borrowed time, on zero interest rates and QE. They're not, in fact, solvent, if you analysed it properly. So the idea that the banks are going to be some kind of cash cow for public services is completely wrong. And this is the delusion that got us into the mess in the first place. And, of course, we're now back to normal with the banks doing what they normally do, except we're still on zero interest rates, effectively. And, as I say, QE is still functioning. We had a big dollop of QE after Brexit. And, of course, when interest rates rise, as they probably will, if there's a run on the pound, the banks will go down the drain.
So who's really running the country? Is it the banks or the government?
It's the banks, Tony. That's a silly question.
How do they? I mean, okay, so they certainly have influence over the political parties and appointments in that way. They'll probably have influence in the media through deciding who gets the loans and who doesn't get the loans.
But also, the influence in the media is by diverting attention from their own egregious misbehaviour onto various other targets, the scroungers on universal credit, immigrants, etc., etc.
Hence the lady from HSBC Risk Committee being the chairman of the BBC. Also, Britain First removed from Facebook this week.
Bridget Phillipson.
Speaker, just minutes ago, Facebook announced that they will be taking down several pages associated with the extremist group Britain First. Yeah. Does the Prime Minister join me in welcoming that? But does she not also accept that there needs to be a clear role provided by government to give guidance to social media companies on how they operate in our democracy? Yeah.
Prime Minister!
I certainly welcome that announcement by Facebook, and I'm pleased to say that my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, has been working with these companies to ensure that they do more, they do act more clearly in taking down material that is of an extremist nature. But I'm very pleased to welcome the announcement that Facebook has made, and I hope other companies will follow.
Sophie Sweetman, who does a programme down in Devon, or I think it's Devon or Cornwall on the radio down there, she got in touch with me earlier on to say that she had been criticising some of the coverage of the Sergei Skripal Salisbury, and she'd got a warning from Facebook saying, just to let you know that if you carry on like this, you'll be breaching our community guidelines. So there are all sorts of possibilities now, aren't there, for just removing people from Facebook. I think David Icke's page. You may not agree with him, but I mean, if you believe in free speech, surely you know you can't.
Nobody believes in absolute freedom of speech, but on the other hand, you've got to, if you're going to take certain groups down, you've got to have a very clear criteria, and it's got to be really incitement to violence. If people are just coming out with rather unpleasant opinions, whatever they may be, then you shouldn't be removing them. And, of course, people on the left who cheer when Britain First are taken down should remember that it's setting a precedent for taking down your stuff when the government doesn't like it. And I'm generally in favour of freedom of speech. Let these fools say whatever they like, and we're going to say whatever we like about them. And, you know, no crying for mummies. That would be my philosophy.
This is definitely the approach in Hong Kong, and the difference in China is there isn't really free speech in mainland China, but there is, I mean, there's much more diverse opinions expressed in Hong Kong. For example, they have a kind of private eye in Hong Kong where there's all sorts of criticisms of and scandals about people at the top of the Hong Kong establishment and the Chinese Communist Party. That is just not done in China.
Well, I think it's all a matter of degree, isn't it? In some places, there's more freedom of speech than in others, but in no country in the world is there absolute freedom of speech.
Well, no, not here, definitely, because we saw the whole business with the Jimmy Savile scandal being outed by Miles Goslett in the Aldi magazine, and then a few months later, he went around all the newspapers in London, he would try Private Eye too, nobody would publish this article about what had happened at the BBC at Newsnight, and finally the Aldi published this article. Anyway, a few months later, Richard Ingrams, who was the editor of the Aldi, was sacked.
Yeah, I mean, the freedom of speech, even where it is allowed, is circumscribed by access to resources. And you don't have to openly silence people. You just sack people who are annoying, make it financially unviable for certain things to exist, and so on. And it's a constant battle.
Okay,
and there's always going to be a row about it as well.
Okay, back to the banks again at Prime Minister's Questions.
It is sadly a matter of public record that RBS and HBOS deliberately asset stripped thousands of potentially viable businesses to benefit their own bank or individual bankers. And evidence before the High Court indicates that Lloyds may also be guilty of the same. Would the Prime Minister consider the calls of the all-party group for fair business banking, which has been endorsed by the Chief Executive of the FCA, Andrew Bailey, for a full public inquiry into this disgraceful scandal?
Minister!
This is an issue that is of concern to many. Small businesses are the backbone of our economy, and we need to ensure that we do learn the lessons that from what happened at RBS and HBOS. And as he will know, the FCA has reported areas of widespread inappropriate treatment of firms by RBS.
who have apologised and set up a scheme for compensation for victims. There is an ongoing investigation which is continuing to be conducted by the FCA into RBS, and they're also undertaking two separate investigations into HBOS. But we will continue to work with the independent regulator and the industry to ensure that small and medium-sized businesses get the support they need.
So no inquiry then, Prime Minister?
No, it won't be, will there? It's interesting, isn't it, that you've got... I mean, we're talking about who runs things. Royal Bank of Scotland, MI5 very close. Actually, you get a check from MI5. Actually, I had to send a... I got a check back from them for something because they wouldn't tell... That's right, I had to send them a check. Then they sent me some money back. That was an RBS... an RBS check sent from MI5, because I tried to get a subject access request to get information about what they held on me. Mm. There. And so also HBOS, also Lloyds. What are they doing actually trying to just bankrupt small businesses?
Well, don't forget that RBS was owned by the government when it was doing this, and they've been tasked by the government of getting back into profit. And so the way they do that is by squeezing all the little fruits that they can get their hands on. And it just shows the predatory nature of finance capitalism. It should actually be run as a public utility, and that's what should have happened in 2008, but didn't, which is why we're going to have another mega crash, and then we'll ask these questions all over again, but with a much more angry voice.
Difficult to tell whether we've got any news coming in the next in half a minute or so. Martin, I think what we'll do in the second hour is we'll start off by having a look at the... the Sergei Skripal scandal. We'll do, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, really pull that one to pieces. And after the news, the Murdoch News at 7.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.